Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So welcome to the Next and Now, the Sydney Institute series of virtual meetings at a time of pandemic, and thanks to our members who have sent in questions for the question discussion period later after the talks. And so today's topic is remembering Paul Ramsay. It's on the occasion which we're doing today of the launch of Angela Shanahan's book, Paul Ramsay, A Man for Others, which has a foreword by John Howard, and we'll be selling that online after this event. Now, we're going to have two speakers today. Tony Abbott, who I should just introduce as Australia's 28th Prime Minister. That's good enough, but also a personal friend of Paul Ramsay from around 1973, so that's about the final four decades of Paul Ramsay's life. And the writer of this book, Angela Shanahan, who is well known to many of you as a Canberra-based columnist and feature writer for The Australian. This is Angela's first book, but I'm sure it won't be her last book. And to launch it, Tony Abbott, many thanks.
The thing about Paul Ramsay is that he always had time for other people. I first met Paul back in 1973 when he gave up his weekend, so typical of him, to drive his brother's rowing crew to a regatta in Canberra. And as a 15-year-old, as I then was, it was hard not to be impressed by this somewhat flamboyant Jaguar driver who smuggled beers into the cafe we subsequently dined at in what was then a semi-prohibitionist Australian Capital Territory. From that time, Paul was a feature in my life, initially an occasional one at Jesuit events, but later a regular one at Liberal Party events, because Paul was a strong and consistent supporter of the conservative side of politics. Not that Paul was ever an ideologue, and he certainly had friends on both sides of the political fence, but he respected, revered even, the country, the church, and the community that had shaped him. And that made him an instinctual conservative. Above all, Paul was a people person. Early on in any conversation with Paul, he would look you straight in the face and say with intensity, "How are you?" And inevitably that was followed up by his next trademark question, what can I do to help? And certainly there are few good people and good causes in this country that Paul has not helped at some stage. Paul was one of those fragrant spirits for whom asking about you was not an excuse to talk about himself. Unusually for someone who achieved so much in such a dog-eat-dog world, Paul's friends were friends for life. He once told me that he had tried never to do a business deal that the other person wouldn't be happy to repeat. Now, not long after becoming opposition leader back in 2010, I judged that I then had the standing as a former student of his Jesuit brothers and as a friend of decades to talk to him about his legacy. He had no children, with the expectation of a massive inheritance, so I thought he ought to do something useful with the fruits of his life's work. What we had had, subsequent generations largely lacked: a grounding in the Western canon gained at school. The model philanthropist was Cecil Rhodes, who hadn't endowed institutions so much as shaped individuals for the world's fight. That's how our conversations developed over several years. And so a proposal steadily took shape, helped by a Julian Lisa paper that Paul commissioned. There would be undergraduate courses and scholarships in the Western canon at three Australian universities. There'd be postgraduate scholarships at the world's best universities for people with an interest in the Western canon and leadership potential. And there'd be seminars, speakers, and summer schools on aspects of Western civilization. Now, just after Ramsay Healthcare celebrated its 50th birthday with a great party at the Sydney Town Hall, because Paul loved a party, he died. But the Ramsay Centre for Western Civilization should be his lasting legacy. You'll note that the Ramsay Centre is not about Western civilization, but for it. This caused much consternation amongst some academics who'd forgotten that questioning everything was at the heart of our civilization and helps to explain its success. No one, indeed, who properly appreciates civilization is blind to its errors. Indeed, that's its strength. It does not assume that our culture, that our way of life, has a monopoly on wisdom and knowledge. In any event, over the past several years, thanks to the fine leadership of its founding director, Professor Simon Haynes, and a good and balanced board that John Howard chairs, undergraduate courses are now up and running at Wollongong University and at the University of Queensland. They'll soon start at the Australian Catholic University, where hopefully there'll also be a one-year master's program too. And next year, the first Ramsay scholars will go to Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, and Stanford. And there is a flourishing speakers program that has so far hosted, among others, the distinguished American sociologist Jonathan Haidt, and perhaps the greatest contemporary English-speaking historian, Andrew Roberts. I am sure that Paul would be proud of what has been done in his name by those who knew him and loved him. And I thank the Ramsay Foundation for its generous and ongoing support, especially the two directors that the Foundation and the Centre have in common, Paul's lifelong friends, Michael Siddle and Peter Evans. Today especially, I want to thank Angela Shanahan for bringing Paul to life in this fine book for those who did not personally know him. For all who did, Paul was a vibrant presence who lives on in our hearts. But memories fade and fail, people pass. By contrast, a book is as imperishable as anything can be in this world. Angela deftly captures the essence of the man and his world, his shyness, his loneliness, his gift for friendship, his instinct for business. And in this vale of tears, in this time of frustration and disappointment, it's a tonic to have in this a permanent memorial to a thoroughly good man who succeeded beyond his wildest dreams because he truly was a man for others. I hope all of you will go on to Amazon Australia and order a copy of this book. It's an easy read, and it will bring to life someone who you should know.
Many thanks to Tony Abbott for a fine introduction to Paul Ramsey, A Man for Others, and now the author Angela Shannon. Angela, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tony, for those rather effusive words. I hope that people actually enjoy reading this book. I didn't want to write a hagiography, but Paul was so well loved that it was very difficult to find anyone who would say anything bad about him. So I just want to say a few things. First of all, why did I write this book? Well, I was actually commissioned to write the book by Peter Evans, who was the accountant in Ramsey Healthcare and who knew Paul from the 1960s, and Tony Clark, who was a great friend of John Howard, who is the chairman of the Ramsey Institute for Western Civilization, now rather the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization. Now, when I was commissioned, I knew nothing about Paul Ramsey. I hadn't even heard of him. And in hindsight, I think that's actually quite a good place to come from for a biographer, because if you know nothing, you haven't got any prejudices about this person. You get a lot of different views. And it was one of the most interesting things about Paul that every single person I ever spoke with, and I did it all from interviews, thought they knew Paul Ramsey. They really knew him. And he was their best friend. He was everybody's best friend. He was a person of a sort of contrast, you might say. It was not easy to pin him down because so many people thought, for example, that he was very effusive and that he loved a party, which he did. He loved a party because he loved having people around. But at the same time, he had a rather shy quality, a rather reticent quality. He was somewhat insecure, I think. I hate to do this, but everyone tends to do this when they're focusing on a single person. You can't help wondering about where all this came from. So I started at the beginning. His sister, who was his twin, was very helpful. And the whole milieu in which they grew up was completely foreign to me, but I managed to sort of put myself in their position, perhaps because I have a lot of children, I don't know. But a little boy who goes to boarding school at the age of five, who was the twin of the two, the twins were the youngest. And in lots of ways, he was the younger of the twins because his sister kind of mothered him a little bit. Now, from there, of course, he went to the Jesuits and he loved the company. He loved being one of the boys. He wanted desperately to be one of the boys. But one of the things about Paul was that he wasn't very good at a lot of that stuff. So he was rather insecure. He tended to be, in a sense, the class fool. And as time went on, he was not academic. He had absolutely basic academic kinds of talents. He got through the leaving all right, and he managed to get into university. But his life didn't seem to be going anywhere. He came from a very old colonial family. His grandfather was one of the founders of Canberra. In fact, his grandfather chose the site of Canberra. And he desperately wanted to live up to the family heritage. But while everyone else was doing business and making money, and they had money, the family weren't poor. As Michael Siddle once said to me, he said to him once, the trouble with you, Paul, is that you were brought up in the gutters of Point Piper. And because he had very rather elevated ideas of the way things should be. But he wasn't doing anything much for himself. Time went on. And the thing that really got him going, he tried all sorts of things. He tried selling real estate. His father was a very well-known developer. Big flop. But the thing that got him going was that he went to a seminar of the Carnegie Method, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And when I first heard about this, it was obviously the formative thing in his life. He said it over and over again. He said, this was the thing that taught me how to get on. He was instinctive. He had the right instincts. So consequently, this thing, which was basically, you know, you have to really understand the other person. As Tony said, you never do a deal that the other person had come out of feeling that he'd been diddled. That was the thing that really got him into the idea of business. Now, one of the things that I actually was asked a lot by other people, was he interested in hospitals because of, you know, it was a people kind of thing. I said, partly, yes, but that's not how he got started in the hospital business, not at all. In fact, the story of how he got started in the hospital business was sheer serendipity. Now, I believe at these sorts of things, it's the thing to read something. So I'm just going to read a little bit here, which is from the prologue, which is about how Paul actually got started. In 1964, the attempts of 25-year-old aspiring property developer Paul Ramsey to break into the world of business seemed destined to fizzle out ignominiously. He'd recently bought Warinna House, a somewhat dilapidated guest house in Mossman, owned by three old ladies. They wanted £17,000 for it, but at auction it was passed in at £16,000, a price they'd unwisely not accepted. Eventually, Paul had bought the house for almost half the initial asking price, which, as he later remarked, only goes to show the truth of my dad's principle that you should always go with the auction price as the real price. At the time, he thought he'd done a very clever deal. Surely, he thought, this purchase would give him the edge he needed to be taken seriously as a developer, a real businessman. But he had no vision for the old guest house, aside from the potential of its land development. Paul's family were in the land development business. He'd been working with his father, Oscar, originally a surveyor, who'd become a successful developer, and he was Paul's chief mentor and financier. However, in a family of high flyers, Paul was considered the plodder. In fact, that's exactly what his sister Anne called him, the plodder. He was academically mediocre and socially awkward, with a reticent nature that bordered on shy. Nevertheless, he was keen to break out and try his hand at the business. He was no sooner the owner of Warinna than his plans began to unravel. Although he'd bought the house cheaply, he couldn't go ahead with his original plan to pull it down and build a block of flats. The council refused to approve his development application, and what was worse, things were not going well with his other developments, most of which he couldn't sell. A severe credit squeeze meant that suburban developments were proving extremely challenging. It was a double whammy. Not only was Paul lumbered with an asset which he wasn't too sure he really wanted, he also faced the humiliating prospect of having to admit his failure in a business in which his family had excelled. His father was not impressed. "You have got yourself into a bit of a hole, haven't you?" Oscar remarked dryly. Paul was desperate. Land development required cash. Faced with the prospect of going broke, still living at home, and with few other assets, he met with his accountant, hoping to find a way out of this financial hole. "What is making money these days?" he asked. The accountant's answer was to the point. "Hospitals," he said. "Convalescent hospitals." Well, Paul didn't have a clue about that. However, unlike most people, and Paul was definitely not like most people, he was curious. And once his curiosity had been piqued, he persisted. Paul was intuitive. The main thing about him, and the reason that this book is a little bit different perhaps from other biographies of businessmen, is that Paul was nothing like any other businessman. He was not a person who had great plans. He didn't go by the account books. He was intuitive. Every single thing he did in his life came from that intuition. And all the people around him who helped him do that were sort of carried along on this. A lot of them got very frustrated. Quite often they thought that he'd made some terrible blues. But in the end, he came out on top. He lost almost as much money as he made, But in the end, he left that $3.5 billion, and he left it for people who needed it in the foundation, in all the work they do, and in the Centre for Western Civilization, which is probably, hopefully, going to be one of the best things he ever did.
So many thanks to Angela Shannon for talking about her book, Paul Ramsay, A Man for Others, and we're going to be selling copies online very soon, and Angela will sign the book, and I'm sure number 28 will also sign the book. Tony Abbott will sign the book too. So now we come to questions and discussion, and there you go. Well, thanks, Tony, and thanks, Angela. So we're talking about Paul Ramsay, A Man for Others. So, Angela, what does A Man for Others mean? And Tony, how was he a man for others? So, Angela.
Well, it's a motto. It's a Jesuit motto that they are now using at Riverview. That wasn't the motto when he was there, but it is their motto now. And it struck me as being very apt, not just because of the hospital business. He was always very interested in what anyone was doing and if he could sort of help them a bit. Sometimes he was a bit, he would forget. They told me a funny story about a waiter they kept meeting at all these dudes who had very bad teeth. You know, he had Dracula-like teeth. And so every time he met him, Paul would say, "I'm going to get your teeth fixed. I'm going to get your teeth fixed." That's the sort of thing he did quite spontaneously. But he did other things, of
course. But did he get his teeth fixed?
No, I don't think the waiter ever got his teeth fixed, because that's the sort of person Paul was. But there were other things that he would do that were quite big. And he would just spontaneously give money to quite a big cause, for example. But the other thing that really struck you was the sort of people that he befriended and how he managed to get them into the business, and how he used that for his business. He understood instinctively that business is really about people. It's not just about the numbers on the sheet. It's really about the people involved. So one of the relationships he had, which I think is a very interesting one, was his relationship with Marjorie. Marjorie Brisley was a lady who had come to work for the Ramsay company as a bookkeeper. She wasn't any great brain box, as Michael Sibyl was at great pains to point out to me, because there was a little bit of frisson between Michael and Marjorie. And she was a bit older than Paul, and her husband died, so there she was, a widow, and she was, you know, being a accountant bookkeeper. And she sort of, Paul befriended her because he felt sorry for her, particularly after her husband's death. And she would give him bits of advice about what to do in the hospitals. And eventually she became his kind of HR type person, I suppose you could say. He used to take her on trips with him. He used to take her to the hospitals. In America, she was invaluable when they decided to buy the HMO. That's a health management company. She went into the clinic. And she walked around and she talked to all the people. She talked to the doctor, she talked to the nurses, she talked to the patients, and she figured out who should run the HMO, particularly in Miami. She understood there was a guy there, and this is another thing. For example, one of the fellows who had been demoted from the company, and Paul took over this company, but the fellow had been demoted and was working in the clinic. He was by profession a pharmacist, actually, but he knew all about the running of the HMO, and he knew about the clinic. And one of the most important things about this clinic was that it was a bit of a drop-in centre for all the old Cubans who used to come and sort of talk. And Louis, that's his name, Louis Lamella, he realised that, you know, they were missing out, because they had sort of decided that perhaps this Australian group might not sort of want the Cubans around. But in fact, it was the opposite. And Marjorie figured this out too. So that's one of the reasons I say he was a man for others. He knew a lot about human psychology almost instinctively. He, and of course he did the Carnegie thing.
So, Tony, A Man for Others, what's your understanding of that, and how do you think Paul Ramsay was a man for others?
Well, Angela's right. It's a Jesuit motto which was certainly bandied around a lot when I was at St. Ignatius College back in the early 1970s. And it means what it says. You are supposed to focus not on yourself. You are supposed to be about helping others rather than helping yourself. And Paul very much lived up to that. If I can tell a little story, the first poly pedal back in 1998 was to raise money for a Western Sydney charity called Youth in Search. And there was a youngster who participated on that ride who was the star pupil of Youth in Search. He'd grown up in Lithgow in very, very difficult circumstances. Yeah. And I got to know him quite well on that ride. And I said to him, what do you want to do? And he said, well, I'd love to be a psychiatrist. Turned out he didn't really know much about psychiatry. And I said, well, you know, to be a psychiatrist, you've got to be a doctor first. Have you thought of that? And he said, well, no, I haven't. And I said, do you know anything about what it takes to get into medicine school? And he said, well, no, I don't. And I suspect there would have been very few of his teachers in those days at Lithgow High that would have had any real sense of what it took. I mentioned this to Paul. Well, within a couple of months, he'd been signed up to Rearview for his final year of school.
While he didn't actually
end up doing medicine, he did go to university. He did study IT. I caught up with him about a decade later. By that stage, he was running a successful small business in IT in my electorate, my former electorate. And most recently, he was a senior executive with quite a large business. So this was a guy who Paul helped. He didn't have to, but he did because of the alchemy of Paul's life. And while things didn't work out exactly as Paul planned, they worked out well. And that was part of the charm and the greatness of this man.
So before we move on, we just go back and just, because he wasn't so well known, because you've made a point, you didn't know about him before you got commissioned to write the book. So very briefly, he's born, what, 1939? He dies...
2014.
Now his education... He starts off young, so when does he go to St. Ignatius College, Riverview, the Jesuit college in Sydney?
Early 50s.
Early 50s. And how long is he there for until he matriculates or reaches year 12? So what happens after that? Because he sort of enters the law school at Sydney, but not for long. So what's the story there?
Well, as Angela recounts in the book, there were various business ventures which... sort of petered out. There was a bit of roaming around in Europe, which again didn't take him very far. But the story that Angela begins the book with, the purchase of this rundown guest house in Mossman, that ultimately became the first hospital in the Ramsay Empire, ultimately a psychiatric hospital. This was the beginning. And as Angela's recounted earlier, it was going nowhere, but that question, what is making money, which was very shrewdly answered by his then accountant.
His family were very, very puzzled by him. Because he was the only one who didn't really shine in anything. His older brother, John, was a Jesuit. He became a Jesuit. Then there was Peter, who was the, as Anne said, John was the gentleman of the family, Peter was the brains, and Paul was just the plotter. That's what she actually said to me. And in a sense, he wasn't expected to do a great deal, but he expected a lot of himself because he came from a very distinguished family. His grandfather had chosen...
So his grandfather is named who?
His grandfather was Austin Chapman, and he was the first Postmaster General, and he was in the very first Parliament. And he was a knight, and they sort of looked up to him. And in fact, at Warina, where they lived in the country, there's a great big portrait of him. You know, he's the sort of great ancestor. And he expected a lot of himself. When you say man for others, he actually did expect a lot of himself. It's civic virtue was something that was very much part of their family.
So in those days, as I understand it, the law school was not on the campus at Sydney, it was in Phillip Street. So what happened at the law? How long did he last at the law? Well, he must have got results good enough to get into law. So how long did he last?
He actually was at the bottom of his class.
And Jared, as you might remember, in those days, it was pre-Whitlam. You had to pay fees to
exactly.
go to university. And if you could pay the fees, you could do the course.
Well, you had to pay fees if you didn't win a scholarship.
That's right.
And he didn't win a scholarship.
No.
But he could pay the fees. Mm. Well, that would explain it. Mm. The rest of us had to win scholarships.
There were some great stars in his class. John Cowdell was in his class. And he was the top of the class. Dunford, John Dunford.
But did he get beyond first, or did he drop out in first year, did he?
He dropped out in first year, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the reason why I asked that is because, and I'll go to you, Tony, because we should come back to you, Angela, later on, there's the Ramsay Foundation, which is the charitable stuff, as I understand it, and there's the Ramsay Centre for Western Civilization, which is what you've been in. You're on the board, and John Howard's the chairman, and they're others on the board. I just wondered how well Ramsay understood universities, because universities weren't the kind of concept that John Henry Newman wrote about. They weren't this great search of wisdom and knowledge as I understood them in the 60s. And I think Ramsay would have understood them if he'd gone to one, but he never really did. Because giving a lot of money to a university usually will end up, as happened with the United States Studies Center, will end up usually being taken over by the left. And so however good your intentions are, they'll probably be counterproductive. So do you think he understood universities when he gave you this money to set up courses in universities?
Well, Jared, I beg to differ, because my experience at university was somewhat different to that which you're driving at. Yes, there was certainly a lot of conflict on campus, ideological conflict, intellectual dissension on campus in my time in the late 1970s and early 80s. But the spirit and the temper of the place was still profoundly conservative in the best sense. Yes, we had the political economy dispute at Sydney University. We had the general philosophy dispute at Sydney University. But both of those involved, yes, a breakaway group of Gramscian radicals, but a very staunch group of intellectual conservatives, not in the sense that they voted liberal, but in the sense that they respected the body of knowledge that had been passed on to them and they wanted to build on it. And that is my idea of a university. That, I think, was Paul's idea of a university. And I suppose one of the things that slightly surprised and disappointed me was the way universities, which had been so initially enthusiastic about the Ramsay Centres coming there, went to water the instant the academic left acted up. Now, I'm pleased, obviously, that we've got three universities, Queensland, Wollongong and the ACU, which are happy and proud to host these centres, which are not about brainwashing in any way, shape or form, but which are about inculcating in the students not an uncritical acceptance, but a decent appreciation of that which has shaped us. Because how can we understand who we are if we don't know where we've come from and what are the ideas and the thoughts, what are the great books, the great thinkers that have made us.
But you're probably lucky in a way, because if you've been taken up by the ANU, Melbourne University in Sydney, which was the original intention, there are not many conservative academics in social sciences in those universities.
Well, the interesting thing is that the Ramsay Centre had a selection process, which would be a partnership with the university, The idea was not just that the existing academic staff would teach the relevant courses, but there would be a body of staff who would go through a selection process that would teach the course, because one of the emphases of the Ramsey Centre is on teaching. We want and we expect these courses to be well taught by people who love teaching, not by academics who see teaching as an unnecessary distraction from their research and their publication. I mean, teaching is at the heart, should be at the heart of these courses, and that's my understanding as to how they're developing.
So Andrew, tell us about his will, if it was a will, or the way he left his money, because the overwhelming bulk of the money goes to the Ramsey Foundation, which is a kind of giving money out to charities, and then a small part of it goes to the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization. So how do the two relate together?
Well, although if it does actually fulfil the complete, you know, thing with the Centre for Civilization, it will be over 20% of the foundation's budget. Now, Paul didn't actually leave in his will any mandate for the foundation. He set up a foundation because he thought that a rich guy should have a foundation. And a few people had said to him, you know, what are you going to do? Have you got any ideas? So he just set it up with $5 million, which to him was really nothing. And he just so that he could set it up. It wasn't until a little bit later that the idea of the Western civilization thing came to fruition. And then he thought, but then the money can come from the foundation. But unfortunately, in his will, he didn't leave any specific mandate for the foundation. So when the foundation, after he died, the foundation had to sort of sit down and figure out what they were going to do with all this money and how they were going to spend it. Now, they knew about the Western civilization and they were all pretty keen on that, but then they had to go overseas and try and sort of model the foundation on other foundations. You know, they looked at quite a few. They looked at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They looked at a whole lot of others. They eventually did find one. I think I've put it in the book there at the back there, which they could model theirs on. What they try to do in the foundation is to give money in three different areas, and preferably if all three meet: education, health, and, for want of a better word, disadvantage. So, for example, I know that they've given a lot of money for this for various education, things for young kids, for preschoolers, and for their health and that sort of thing. In Western Australia, there's a big longitudinal study going on that they've funded. There is another thing, research for the coronavirus vaccine. I know they've given money to Queensland University for what they're doing there. And things like that, you know what I'm saying? But they, as far as the Western civilization thing is concerned, it's sort of separate. But the money comes from the foundation. Yeah.
There was a guarantee.
Well, this is the problem. Part of the guarantee seems to be, well, it's guaranteed for the next 4 years, but whether or not it'll continue after that. I did write a piece in The Australian about this, that I had heard that they hadn't had an absolute guarantee that it would be funded after this 4 years. And I don't know if anything has happened since then.
Look, I have no reason to think that the foundation won't continue to fund the centre, particularly now that the centre is successfully up and running. I think that the controversy which dogged the centre early on has been magnificently overcome, thanks in part to Simon Haynes and in part to John Howard. And the fact that the staff of the centre are so thoroughly professional and have been so completely open with the universities that they're dealing with. So I'm confident that the foundation will be sufficiently proud of the work that the centre is doing to be continuing funders of it. And certainly I'm very confident that Paul would be extremely proud of the work that the centre is doing.
Well, one would hope so, but I'm kind of a bit suspicious that it's not going to continue beyond the absolute agreed time.
Which was?
Which is, what, until 2024, isn't it?
10 years after
it. It was essentially an 8-year funding commitment that the foundation first gave.
So it's 26, actually. Yeah, 26. And then after that, it depends. I'm not the only person who's written about this. The left-wing press has been talking about it, actually, quite oddly, quite fairly in lots of ways.
So tell me about Paul. Was he the only person who read Carnegie's How to Make Friends and Influence People and it worked?
Oh, I don't know.
I mean,
I have to tell you that when I found out about this, I was a little bit shocked. I didn't think anyone took it that seriously.
No.
But boy, did he take it seriously, and he made all the employees do it and all his partners and the Siddle family all do it. And, yes, they take it very seriously.
So he made friends. And he certainly influenced people, but he made friends.
Mm.
Perhaps I should buy a copy.
Personal relations.
Well,
it's not too late.
I thoroughly recommend it.
Was it?
I read How to Win Friends and Influence People.
You reckon it worked for you?
I'm not sure how much I've influenced people, but I've certainly kept some friends for many, many years. No, look, I think
it's
as a practical manual,
yes,
and as a kind of a guide to common sense behaviour, I think it's a very accessible thing. And I would certainly have no hesitation
I think it suits a certain sort of personality. That's the thing. And Paul had that. Paul had that desire to make people like him. He really wanted people to like him. And that's
not a bad thing.
No, I mean, nothing was bad.
We shouldn't
bad.
Go through life encouraging people to dislike us.
Even though some of us
have succeeded better than others at it.
Well, I think we three are probably people who would not fit that thing.
But, well, I've never sought to have people like me.
It's changed as it goes on through the generations. Mm. Because it was actually written in 1930. It was written in the Depression.
Yeah.
And it was written in order for people to try and get a job, basically.
Mm.
But as it's changed and over time, it's become much more sophisticated.
Mm.
And there are seminars and, you know, they do all sorts of things.
Yeah. Mm. I must enrol. Now, tell us about Paul Ramsey. I mean, A Man for Others. I think that's attributed, maybe falsely, to St. Ignatius of Loyola, who sort of went into battle for the Catholic Church after the Protestant Reformation and during the Counter-Reformation. But tell us about his religious attitudes, because he went to a Catholic school, and did he remain a believer? Was he a regular church attender, or what was he like?
He tried to go to Mass whenever he could, I was told. If he had a very peripatetic lifestyle. He travelled continuously. He virtually never spent the same night, two nights in a row in the same place. So whenever he was, you know, particularly in London, he liked going to the Jesuit church in London. Yes, he was definitely a believer. I was told by his man Friday, who was the guy who did everything for him.
Basically. Okay, so who are we talking about?
Oh, this is Chris Gunn.
Yes, okay.
Chris Gunn, who was his man Friday.
He's photographed in the book, right?
And everything else. He told me he knelt down every night before he went to bed and said his prayers. I think he was...
But he didn't leave any money to the church.
No.
Over the years, Paul had given an enormous amount of support to places like Riverview. I mean, there's the Ramsey Hall at Riverview, which was a multi-million dollar investment. So there was a lot of generosity over the years to various church agencies. Look, Paul and I had this discussion. I said, of course you can give your money to the Jesuits, mate, but the Jesuits are set in their path and they will just keep doing whatever it is they're doing. Or you can put it into something which is new, which is separate, which is yours, and which is going to make a difference. And that's why I think he was particularly attracted to the idea of the Centre for Western Civilization.
He actually supported a school in Timor too, mm-hmm. a Jesuit school was set up.
Was he a reader? Did he know much about Western civilization? Or did he just like what he thought it was?
He wasn't. He loved, and he liked biographies of great men, mm-hmm. and he was always carrying around biographies of great men. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of his friends told me he went to Russia with a biography of Peter the Great, and he said mm-hmm. he didn't think he ever got past the first three pages. But that's the sort of person he was. At his home, you can see, you know, there's a biography of Winston Churchill and this and that. He read an enormous amount of papers and periodicals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He always had newspapers, and people mm-hmm. would say to me, oh, he was a great reader. But in fact, one of his friends, the person who was shared his life almost towards the end of his life, told me, Sadam Savchenko told me he never really finished a whole book. He would, but he would read the paper from beginning to end every morning, and that was part of his method, his working method.
Well, he would learn a lot.
Well, he would find out what was going on, mm-hmm. and he would ring people up every single day, mm-hmm. and he would take notes, sometimes word for word, about what they said. And sometimes, I mean, somebody told me that he actually tended to sort of parrot back to people and everything he learnt from somebody else. And he said the funniest thing was is when he actually parroted something back that you told him.
Flattering.
But
here's a man, you say...
Affairs, you know, always...
But why his restlessness? I mean, you're saying that... I mean, he's a man of great wealth and he can go where he wants to go, but it is odd that he never spent more than a very brief time at any one place. I mean, he always has to be moving. Why is that?
I don't know, really. That was
what was he escaping? Was he escaping from something?
Well, he had business interests that eventually spanned the globe. I mean, he had hospitals in France. He had hospitals in the United States.
Yes.
He had hospitals in Britain. He had hospitals in Indonesia and elsewhere.
France. He owned the biggest hospital company in France. And he would go every year to Europe. He had two boats, one in... And he was actually building another one when he died in Europe. And he spent a lot of time sort of moseying around and everyone else sort of doing a lot of hard yakka.
But and he had friends in all these places that he liked to visit.
Exactly. But was he escaping something that he's always moving?
Was he escaping? I think he was lonely in lots of ways. I don't think he fitted in to any milieu. The old school milieu he enjoyed up to a point. But then he would sort of push off. A lot of them said to me, you know, Paul, you'd invite him for something and you'd think he would come and he just didn't show up. And he would often do that. I think he was a bit escaping. I think his psychology was...
Or is that just rudeness?
Rudeness. I think.
Well, it's pretty rude not to show up, isn't it?
Well, it was a bit. One poor woman, he rang up one night, he was in Hong Kong, and she had a dinner and everything, you know, and he said, sorry, I'm in Hong Kong.
He may have.
But they all laughed about it. This is the thing.
I've got to have a lot of money, that's why they laughed about it. If you'd done it, they wouldn't have.
I know, that's probably true.
Or you.
Yeah. But on the other hand, he used to take whole families with him on these trips. For instance, there's a family called the Shipways. Now, they often used to go off on the boat and he'd take them, you know, to play. He'd take them to the Olympic Games. He went to every single Olympic Games but two in his lifetime, and he would take them to all these things. And they just, they couldn't get over it. You know, there was a lot of generosity like that.
See, Joe, the interesting thing about Paul is that if you just look at the bare bones, you can say he was an unusual person. And you can speculate on what may or may not have been his inner demons. But everyone who knew Paul found this person, who might occasionally be vague, but who was genuinely interested in them and went out of his way, sometimes to an almost superhuman extent, to be helpful. And this is why I think Angela gets to the heart of it when she says that he was, in a remarkable sense, a man for others. He seemed to be almost uniquely engaged with others.
I think the biggest sorrow of his life was not having children of his own. And he actually told somebody that right at the end of his life. And they said, well, why didn't you? He said, well, pretty obvious, I didn't get married. It wasn't as obvious to the young person who asked him. But we live in different times. But he was, I think, you know, as I said, he was completely unique in his family. He wasn't like the others. He wasn't like them. He didn't get on very well with his brother for a very long time.
Which brother was this?
No, the middle one. The elder one.
The Jesuit's the elder brother.
The elder one he absolutely idolised.
Yeah.
He was the idol. And in fact, he and Paul even looked a lot like one another.
Yeah.
But the middle one, Peter, the mathematician, he was running the business. And when the parents died, they had a big bust-up because he wanted to continue to run the business. And, you know, Paul needed money and this, that and the other. And his sister sided with Paul. So
if you invite him to dinner and he rings you from Hong Kong and says he's not coming, or if he has a row with his brother over fighting over the family leftovers, I mean, is he a man for others or a man for himself?
No, that was a very different situation, that Wilson. That was he was right with that. And the sister backed him up because they wanted the business sold and the house sold and for the proceeds to be divided. But the middle brother wanted to continue to run the business. I mean, he had run the business with his father, but, you know, they needed the money and she needed the money too. So I think he did the right thing there. I do think that he was a bit lackadaisical about this sort of thing, you know, about not always showing up.
He could be a bit vague.
Yeah. Vague, yeah.
He was a bit vague.
And people used to say that he was a bit vague. Apparently James Packer thought he was just wonderful and wanted to know one day, asked Paul, Paul Keating actually, was on the boat, and he said, how did such a nice guy ever become so rich and successful? He never met anyone quite like that.
But if he ends up with $3 billion change when he dies... He can't have been nice to everyone. It's a pretty tough world out there, you know.
He never sacked anyone. He had
sounds like the public service.
Win friends and influence people. He got everyone else to do that stuff. Mm. He ran the company very much at arm's length.
But he did treat his staff as family.
Yeah. They all came on the boat.
And look, I know. Mm. I introduced Paul to different people. Who he tried to help.
Yeah.
And once he had tried to help them, it wasn't like they were customers or they were business partners. It was like they were part of the family.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that a number of people who Paul had made investments in, in his will, he basically gifted those investments to those individuals, which again is very rare and remarkable.
It is. Warwick Smith, who, as he put it, I'm a hard-headed banker, he said, and the guy, he said, people would just walk on water for him. And he said, we realised he was a good risk.
There was nothing mercenary.
He was a terrible borrower, Jared. He borrowed to the hilt all the time. He was fearless, a fearless borrower. And Warwick Smith said to me that, you know, most people, you would think they'd just go under and they would take too many risks. But somehow or other, the banks always trusted him. They thought that they trusted him to do well. Also, too, I think the hospital business is a good business at core.
Yeah.
The other thing about Paul is he always bought hospitals with good real estate because he knew deep down that that your wealth in the land was more important than anything.
Okay, well, just final question. He dies, you're at his send-off. What happened?
Well, he died too soon. He had a magnificent send-off. There was a glittering array of people turned up at Barrow Catholic Church to farewell him. A current Prime Minister, a former Prime Minister, who's who of business.
Mm. People in tears, like James Packer.
It was an extraordinary send-off because, again, this unusual and in some ways eccentric person managed to touch people in a way that very few others do. And he was the absolute antithesis of your driven, domineering, demanding, grasping tycoon.
Okay.
The antithesis of it.
That's a great moment on which to end. So all the best, Angela, for the success of Paul Ramsay, A Man for Others. And I think we made him interesting today.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.